Everyone, thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. It's October 2018, and you're listening to episode 95 of Postmodern Realities, and I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. On this episode, I'm joined by Melissa Kane Travis. Melissa is an assistant professor of apologetics at Houston Baptist University, and she's a PhD candidate at Faulkner University. She's the author of Science and the Mind of the Maker, What the Conversation Between Faith and Science Reveals About God, and it was published this year. In the 2018 volume 41, number 5 issue of the Christian Research Journal, Melissa has written a feature article called Virtue, Human Nature, and the Quest for Happiness. Melissa, it's good to have you on.
Thank you, Melanie. I'm glad to be with you.
So what inspired you to write about the topic of human happiness? That seems like such a huge topic. What does it mean to be happy? What is that?
Yeah. So over the past year or so, I've noticed in both academic and general media that happiness is a bit of a hot topic. Now, obviously, it's been a chief aim of humanity since the beginning of recorded history as we know it. But as a subject of popular discussion and academic study, it seems to be particularly trendy lately. And as I mentioned in my article, there's been a fresh spate of self-help books with this overt theme of happiness. What is it? How to get it? And then I noticed a really interesting article in an issue of the New York Times that talked about a university course at Yale entirely devoted to helping students learn how to be happier. And I thought that was utterly fascinating. And that got me thinking about the fact that at the end of the day, happiness, by one definition or another, is one of the most significant motivators in our culture. And because of that, I think we need to engage that for the kingdom. We should be asking deeper questions about what authentic happiness is and how to best pursue it. And then we need to be able to talk about those things as we carry out the project of evangelism.
I think if you ask most non-religious parents, or maybe even religious parents, they would say, you know, what do you want for your kids? And their number one thing was they can do anything they want as long as they're happy. So what do secular intellectuals say about human happiness? How do they couch that now? Because that seems vague to me. Your kids can do anything as long as they're happy. What does that exactly mean?
Right. We have to define what we're talking about. We are not all on the same page about this word. Now, I haven't done a canvassing of all the recent publications, but based on what I have read over the past year, I've observed a couple of really interesting themes in this conversation. I listened to a few of the recorded lectures from that Yale University happiness course, and actually some of the precepts being taught were quite admirable. For example, the idea that human beings need a purpose that goes beyond their own immediate needs and desires, that selflessness, doing things for the good of other people, promotes in us a stronger sense of well-being. And then, of course, that big buzzword in so-called secular spirituality, gratitude. You hear that word everywhere lately. And we define that as the conscious practice of cultivating a sense of thankfulness for the good things we have in our life. So notice that even in a secular college course, there's this overarching claim that how you choose to live determines to a large extent how happy you are. So the recognition of the connection between certain values, these particular values that I just mentioned, and human happiness is especially fascinating to me because these values are firmly rooted in the theistic worldview.
Well, in the article, you specifically mentioned that Aristotle connected happiness to virtuous living, like you were saying, this Yale course does explore that. So can you explain his view about that and tell us why that's relevant to us today in the contemporary conversation?
Sure. So Aristotle understood happiness as the state of flourishing as a human being. The Greek word is eudaimonia. He thought that in order for us to properly flourish as the kinds of things we are, we need things like goods of the body. We need certain physical necessities. We need adequate health. And then we also need what he saw as the more important goods, the goods of the soul, he called them. And then all of these goods together are what enable us to live well and do well, to flourish, to have eudaimonia. Now, the good of the soul, according to Aristotle, is what is achieved by virtuous living. So when we intentionally live virtuously, our soul flourishes. In other words, when we do good, we become good, and then the good man is a happy man. And then, as I mentioned a moment ago, the contemporary conversation on human happiness includes this idea that there are certain ways of living that contribute to our well-being, to what we could call, in Aristotle's term, our flourishing. And some of what's recommended, like in the Yale course, for example, doing things that contribute to the well-being of others, to the good of society, we could definitely call virtuous actions. I think Aristotle would agree that those things are virtuous actions. So we see a close parallel between Aristotle's prescription for human flourishing and what's being recommended today, even in the secular academic setting.
So Aristotle was a pre-Christian pagan philosopher, but what similarities can we see between his ideas and those of Christian philosophers?
Well, let's take the great Christian philosopher Thomas Aquinas, for example. Aquinas was actually an Aristotelian, but only to the extent that Aristotle's ideas could be harmonized with Christian teaching. Aquinas said that happiness is something that he referred to as a state of perfection of the soul. And he said that this kind of perfection can only come from direct communion with the perfect good, which is, of course, according to Aquinas, God himself. And that can't happen until after you die. You can't have direct communion with God while you're still alive on earth. So in this life, he said, it's impossible to achieve this perfect happiness that is the goal of the Christian life. But the situation isn't hopeless for us while we're still here, he said, because we can attain a certain degree of happiness by living virtuously. He said, happiness is the reward of works of virtue. So it's by our powers of rationality and free will that we can understand what's virtuous and then do what's virtuous. So we see here a great agreement between Aristotle and Aquinas. The soul is the discerner of the good, and then we have the power to choose the good and do the good. And as a result of this, we flourish. We're happier people.
So if these philosophers are correct and virtuous living is essential, it's a part of a component of happiness in this life, what kind of conflict does this present for the naturalistic worldview?
Well, there are two main conflicts, basically, that arise here. First of all, in the naturalistic worldview, there is absolutely no standard by which to determine whether or not any action is virtuous. We have different cultures and even different individuals who have differing perspectives on morality. I was reading an article in a medical ethics journal just the other day, and it said, in cases of babies unexpectedly born with things like severe genetic abnormalities or permanent disabilities from a birth injury, these authors actually argued that in cases like that, infanticide should be legal because it would be for the good of the family that the child is born into, as well as for the good of broader society just because of the burden that lifelong medical expenses impose upon the family and then possibly the taxpayers. So in other words, they were saying ending the child's life is the virtuous thing to do. Now, I regard that suggestion with horror because I believe that the virtuous course of action is to do everything we can to protect those vulnerable newborns. Now, that's a drastic example of how we can differ among ourselves about what the virtuous course of action is, but we can look back on history and give many, many examples in which there's great disagreement over what constitutes a virtuous action. Nazi Germany is an obvious one. Legal slavery in the antebellum South right here in America. So if we're going to say things like that aren't morally good, that those were not virtuous things for those people to do, we have to have an objective measuring rod that isn't the product of our own human invention. And naturalism will never have that. The best the naturalist can do is just arbitrarily select the moral values and duties that they like. In other words, just basing it on emotion and personal preference. And this is where a whole lot of debate rages in the area of moral philosophy. But there are, in fact, some atheist philosophers out there who bite the bullet and they affirm that in their worldview, in the worldview of naturalism, there isn't any room for any sort of objective morality. And so on their worldview, the concept of virtue is empty. And if we're going to even be able to use the word with any meaning whatsoever, it's just the meaning that we invent for it out of thin air. So that's the first conflict. There's no way to even define virtue in any objective sense. And the second conflict for naturalism is the issue of choosing a virtuous action. So there are excellent arguments for the claim that if naturalism is true, then we're entirely at the mercy of our brain chemistry when it comes to making any and all decisions. In other words, we aren't autonomous agents who freely deliberate over something and then choose a course of action based upon any criteria, such as standards of virtue. We're just dancing to the tune of our DNA, to use Richard Dawkins' phrase. So the picture for naturalism is very bleak when it comes to there being, first of all, any such thing as virtue, much less when it comes to there being any way to connect it to the intentional pursuit of happiness or human flourishing. We're just doomed to whatever life our external circumstances and brain chemicals give us. And then our consciousness is just along for the ride, so to speak.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Melissa Kane Travis, and in the 2018 Volume 41, Number 5 issue of the Christian Research Journal, Melissa has written a feature article called Virtue, Human Nature, and the Quest for Happiness. To read her article along with our cover feature article, Solo Sex and the Christian, please subscribe to the journal. A 6-issue subscription is now at a new lower price of $33.50. And to subscribe to our journal, please visit our website, equip.org. We were just talking about virtuous living in the context of a naturalistic worldview. So don't some naturalists simply make the claim that there are things we all agree on as being morally correct or morally wrong? Recently, I was having a conversation on my Facebook page, and someone who said they were atheist would say, well, we determine what's right just by the majority. If the majority of the people think that that's right, then that's what we should do. So in other words, how should we challenge the consensus argument for morality in the naturalistic worldview?
Well, I think one major thing to point out is there's only very rarely unanimity on any particular moral issue. Opinions vary from person to person, from place to place, and they change over time from one era to the next. So without a standard that totally transcends human life, you're left with one that's subject to the current taste of the majority. Okay. So we often hear this claim, well, it's whatever the majority consensus of society is. And then you just have to ask the question, well, how do we know that what the majority decides is actually true in any objective sense? And then we, like I said a few moments ago, we can point to past history, the antebellum South in the United States, where the majority of Southerners thought that slavery should be illegal. Can we point to that and then say, okay, well, that was moral for them, or that was virtuous for them? And same thing with things like child sacrifice in Central America centuries ago, or Nazi Germany. It's not enough to just have some sort of majority consensus on morality. We have to have something that transcends human invention.
So who are some celebrated atheist thinkers that might make some surprising admissions about God and the possibility of objective virtue? Can you talk to us about that?
Sure. So a good example would be Friedrich Nietzsche. He was a philosopher who lived in the 19th century, and he was quite clear on his belief that there isn't any such thing as moral fact or moral accountability if there's no such thing as God. He even said that any attempt to coerce mankind, to coerce society into any sort of moral framework was itself a thoroughly immoral thing to do. And then another philosopher, an existentialist philosopher from the 20th century, Jean-Paul Sartre, he acknowledged that everything is morally permissible if God doesn't exist. That's from his book entitled Existentialism is a Humanism. And in that passage where he says everything's morally permissible if there is no God, he was actually paraphrasing a very famous passage from Dostoevsky's novel, The Brothers Karamazov, which, by the way, for the listeners out there, is an excellent study on the topic of virtue and human flourishing, and also on the problem of evil and suffering. So those are two philosophers from the past two centuries. And then we have contemporary atheist philosophers who are also what we would call moral nihilists, like Richard Taylor or Alex Rosenberg over at Duke University. And both of them recognize that if atheism is true, if the naturalistic worldview is true, there's nothing in which we can ground morality.
It seems that, you know, for the average person out there, not these, you know, philosophers, people who would claim that they're non-theists today, it seems rare to encounter those kind of non-theists who would affirm this kind of nihilism. So then how can we have a productive conversation about the insufficiency of their worldview, specifically in terms of linking virtuous living and happiness? And, you know, you talked about how this article can really help us in an evangelistic sense. And again, just recent conversations I've had on social media with personal friends that I know who are non-theists, you know, how do we address those folks where the rubber meets the road, I guess, just in our everyday life?
Yeah, it's definitely a challenge to have good, productive conversations about issues like this because they're so emotionally charged. Right. But the best thing to do, I think, is to really focus in on this grounding problem. Ask the person lots of questions with gentleness and respect, of course, about why any human convention deserves to be considered the absolute truth about morality. And then I would encourage believers to really brush up on their reading of atheist moral philosophers to get a really good feel for the arguments that what we call the moral realists and the moral nihilists are both making. So atheists who are moral realists or who would affirm that there is such thing as objective morality, and then atheist moral nihilists who make the opposite argument. So in addition to guys like Richard Taylor and Alex Rosenberg for the nihilist position, they could read someone like Eric Wielenberg. Eric Wielenberg is a moral realist, and they could get his perspective in order to get a good feel for how the non-theist might attempt to affirm objective morality without believing in the existence of God. So I guess my bottom line here is, I think it's important for us as believers to equip ourselves in particular by reading the points of view of non-theists in their own words, and not getting bogged down in all the details of the broader debate, but really zero in on that grounding problem, because that's the linchpin of the entire thing.
You mentioned Alex Rosenberg, and I just wanted our listeners to know that we have an in-depth critique of his book, The Atheist's Guide to Reality, that was published in 2011, and it's free online at our website, equip.org, if they want to read his book and then take a look at our critique of it. So how can we as Christians best articulate the advantages of our Christian worldview?
Well, first and foremost, we can point out that Christianity supplies us with the crucial missing piece. It supplies us with a transcendent, perfect good, which is what Aquinas called God. If we have a transcendent, perfect good, namely God, then morality is grounded in the very character of that God. And so we end up with an unmoving standard, and the concept of virtue comes to have real meaning because we have objective morality. And then moreover, if Christianity is true, then we are, in fact, more than our biology. We have immaterial souls that can freely choose virtue and thereby make conscious choices that lead to our flourishing. In other words, within the framework of the Christian worldview, we can actually pursue happiness, whereas in the naturalistic worldview, that's just an illusion.
Well, one aspect of happiness I know a lot of non-religious people think about is the pursuit of things that are pleasurable to them, that make them happy, and maybe Christians would think that's bad to pursue those things. Is seeking pleasure, is there a proper place for that in the Christian understanding of happiness? And I'm not talking about pleasure in terms of like sexuality, if, you know, people are thinking of that, but just things that make you bring pleasure to your life. Are those things unbiblical, or can we not pursue those things in a Christian worldview and our understanding of what happiness is?
Well, I'd say absolutely yes, there is a proper place for pleasure in the Christian understanding of the pursuit of happiness. And some listeners might be surprised to hear me say that. God created many things for both our sensory pleasure and our intellectual pleasure. And it's only when we pursue good pleasures in the wrong way, in the wrong framework, going against God's moral law in order to have those pleasures, that we go terribly wrong and we enter into the realm of sin. In his book, Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis said something very similar to that. He said, when it comes to good things, and he used pleasure as just one example of a good thing, he said, sin comes about when we pursue that good thing by the wrong method, in the wrong way, or if we pursue it too much. So that would apply to things like good food, or the pursuit of money. Money is objectively a good thing because we use it to procure the things that we need to survive and in some respects to flourish. Sexual pleasure is another example. Sexual pleasure it's a good thing designed by God. And when we pursue that within the bounds of a faithful marriage between a man and a woman, it's a morally correct thing to do to pursue that pleasure. But otherwise, if we're outside of God's plan for that pleasure, it's just reduced to a sinful hedonism, and it results in wounding our soul rather than contributing to our flourishing. So yes, there is a beautiful place in the Christian worldview for the pursuit of pleasure, as long as we pursue that pleasure the way God intended for us to.
Well, a few minutes ago, you talked about having our listeners brush up on, you know, familiarizing themselves with this subject more. And so I'd like to ask you if you could offer a few recommendations for our listeners if they want to do any further reading on this issue.
Sure. I love giving recommendations. And because I'm a huge fan of Christians understanding intellectual history, I'll start with Aristotle and Aquinas. Mortimer Adler, he's no longer living, great intellect of the 20th century. He wrote a book called Aristotle for Everybody, and that's a wonderful choice for a good introduction to Aristotelian thought. The contemporary philosopher Edward Fazer has a very good introduction to Thomas Aquinas. I think it's just entitled Aquinas. And then I also highly recommend a short book entitled Relativism, and that's by Greg Kokel and Francis Beckwith. That's really an apologetics classic, and it deals with the best strategies for arguing against moral relativism. And then last but not least, for those that want to go a whole lot deeper, J.P. Moreland and William Lane Craig have recently released a revised edition of their volume entitled Philosophical Foundations for a Christian Worldview. And it has a wonderful extensive section on the issue of classical virtue ethics. And it covers quite a bit of the ground that we've covered in our conversation tonight.
Well, thanks for those recommendations. And finally, I want to end with some fun rapid fire questions for Melissa. So, Melissa, it's October. Pumpkin spice latte or pumpkin pie?
Pumpkin pie.
What's one of your favorite hobbies?
Oh, favorite hobby. That's a hard one. Reading. Is that boring? Reading's my favorite hobby.
And are you an introvert or extrovert?
Oh, introvert.
And how old were you when you became a Christian?
I was 6.
Well, that's very encouraging, probably for any of our parents out there listening. Well, thanks, Melissa, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Today's guest is Melissa Kane Travis, and in the 2018 Volume 41, Number 5 issue of the Christian Research Journal, Melissa has written a feature article, and it's called Virtue, Human Nature, and the Quest for Happiness. And to read her article, please subscribe to our journal. A 6-issue subscription is now at a new lower price of $33.50. And to subscribe, go to our website, equip.org. We'd like to hear from you, so connect with us on social media, like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, and follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Hanegraaff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. Follow the Bible Answer Man on Instagram, and please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes. And when you rate and review our podcast, it helps others to find our content. So please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and subscribe to Hank Unplugged. It's Hank's new audio podcast. You'll follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.